You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Margaret Mead famously said in 1949 that fathers are a biological necessity but a social accident, she was presciently predicting Michael Lewis's parenting experiences. As a writer living in Berkeley, California, with the doctrines of attachment parenting, breastfeeding, co-sleeping, home birthing with doulas and midwives can feel intense, Mr. Lewis tried to buck the reigning orthodoxy, and what happened, as he relates in his latest book called Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood, turned out to be both hilarious and touching. The book is published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it has brought Michael Lewis back to the show. It's always a pleasure to see you, Mike.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me back.
At the end of the book, you explain that much of this book appeared over the last 8 years as part of a peripatetic series in Slate. Have you received a lot of mail in response to those essays?
Yes, a lot of response to them over the years. It started really accidentally. What happened was, all of a sudden I'm a father, and I've got stacks of books around me to explain what that's supposed to be like, and nothing described the experience. And
why do you think that is?
It's a really good question. I think it's there are lots of reasons for it, but at the bottom, it's the social taboo in complaining about it. But the embarrassment of it. This is what it reminded me of. You tell all your friends you're going on a fancy trip to Paris, and they're all envious of you. And you go off to Paris, and you get there and you get food poisoning, and the French are rude to you, and then maybe you get mugged, and one bad thing happens after another. You have a miserable time. You come home, and everybody wants to know how Paris was, and you can't get it out of your mouth that it was horrible. You don't want to be the person who went to Paris and had a horrible time, so you lie about it, and you lie about it enough, and remember only the little sliver of pleasure you had. That 6 months later, you're telling a completely fictitious story about your trip to Paris. Being a father is like that. If you catch one at the wrong time, like right after the baby comes out, you might get the truth about the trip to Paris. But if you ask him 6 months later, it was just wonderful.
It's interesting that you say that, because you do take a trip to Paris in this book.
Metaphorically and actually, yes.
It didn't turn out as bad. You didn't get food poisoning.
Oh, I did, and over. But no, we moved to Paris. So, when my wife, Tabitha, and I, when she got pregnant, we realized that the world was going to shrink very fast. And we wanted to keep it broad. And we said, well, why don't we go have this experience in some alien place? And one thing led to another, and we were in Paris. And when I started to actually write these things for Slate, it was meant to be a diary of living in Paris. And it was overwhelmed by this experience of new parenthood. Paris, the backdrop might as well have been Bangladesh. It didn't matter. That all of the energy was about this little monster in our midst. It was disrupting our lives.
Well, while you were living in Paris, you ended up in a swimming pool with, you say, a dozen scantily clad Frenchmen, all accompanied by their newborn babies. Much of this book is about bringing up kids in Berkeley, California. Did you find that when you were living in Paris, people do have different attitudes than they do in Berkeley? And do they have different attitudes in Berkeley than they do in the rest of the country?
Well, in Paris, you can bring your dog to a restaurant but not your baby. But in Berkeley, you can bring your baby but not your dog. And that kind of captures a lot of it. There was not the aura of sanctity that surrounds a father with a baby wandering around the United States. Vanishes when you hit France. You don't get the same level of credit just for showing up.
But there's gymboree in Paris.
There are things to do. My wife was very good at finding the things to do with small children, because those were the only things we could do, kind of thing. But there are differences in the environment. But the experience itself is what captivated me, because it was what led me to write about it, I think, because it was so, I expected to feel a certain way once I became a father, and I didn't feel that way. In fact, I felt absolutely nothing for this thing that arrived in our lives. And it wasn't till I put in an awful lot of time taking care of this thing, that the attachment developed. And that stretch of having this child in your life without feeling what the world around you assumes you feel is very unsettling.
Well, it's different for a mother, isn't it? Supposedly there's instant bonding while still in the hospital.
I think it's more likely for the mother, certainly in our case. And that was true. But I don't think it's always true. And I think people feel, this is what you were asking me, what are the responses to the pieces of this book that appear
in print? You feel guilty because you're not feeling the way people tell you you're supposed to feel.
That's exactly right.
And this is a great moment of fulfillment, and everybody has to say, I love my kids. They have my greatest pride and joy. And you probably have had some ambivalence over the years.
Yes, and well, especially in the beginning. And what I did find was that people were relieved that this was an acceptable response to it, and relieved to know that even if you felt this way in the beginning, if you worked through it, you ended up someplace else.
You tell a hilarious story from Paris when you were left with your daughter, Quinn, who got sick, and you did all the things you're supposed to do.
Yeah, well, one of the recurring themes in this story is having had a very traditional 1970s father, a father who did very little but put the bread on the table. I had no sense of what it was I was supposed to do. And then all of a sudden, there are all these new duties that you're supposed to assume. And not only assume them, but assume them well. And the one day in Paris, I'd come home. We'd had a babysitter in the afternoon. I come home to find the babysitter brandishing my child, French babysitter, saying that my child had red spots all over her and it was running a fever. And in Paris, they have this great thing called SOS Médecin. You go on the Yellow Page, you pick up the phone, and moments later, there's a white ambulance in the front of your house and a doctor shows up.
And it's a lot less expensive than here.
Yes, it's cheap. And Tabitha, my wife, was not there. So I thought, this is great. I'm going to demonstrate that I know how to do this fathering thing. So I got the doctor over. My French was broken, but we had this kind of charade where I was figuring out what he was saying. And he says, after about 20 minutes, he looks over and he pronounces varicelle, chicken pox. And he gives me most amazing thing about these French doctors is that they give you, for what you think is a single ailment, long lists of medications to go get. So I went and got this long list of medications, and they were things for her to swallow and things to put on the skin and one thing after another. I did it all. And 2 hours later, in walks my wife. And she says, what's going on? And I said, well, the bad news is that Quinn has chicken pox. The good news is I've sorted it all out. And she says, what do you mean she has chicken pox? I said, well, look at her. She says, did you ask him why the red dots aren't on her arms, just on her face, why they're nowhere else? Did you ask him why she had a fever a week ago but no red dots? She started to run down the list of things I should have asked the doctor. Within about 10 minutes, she'd reduced me to the incompetent father and says, we got to take her back to the hospital. So off we go to the hospital. Me being a little huffy about having put all this effort into it, and now I've got to go do this now too. We get to the doctor's office. He takes one look at her. He says, "Not chicken pox," and all this stuff you've given her, you shouldn't have given it to her. I said, "Well, what about this guy who came over to our house and went through all this?" He says, "What's his name?" I gave him his name. He said, "Oh," he started laughing. He said, "He's very famous for his golf game."
But this is not your fault. You did Michael.
But the presumption of incompetence was what was at the bottom of it. And it's a presumption that is not entirely unwarranted, but does recur in our family life.
Well, what do you think? You talk about your father. My father was like that too. He came home and he buried his face in a newspaper. And because of that, I have tried to be exactly the opposite, because I knew how much it upset my mother when he did it with that. He was that way with my siblings. I observed it, and I thought, I'll never be like that. But that doesn't mean that I necessarily know what to do.
Here's the thing. My father was a wonderful father.
And Robert Young was on television, on Father Knows Best. He knew everything.
My father was a wonderful father for his generation. We have a very close, deep relationship. But he never did any of the dirty work. He didn't come home and bury his head in the newspaper. We had a relationship. But he didn't do any of the work. He did the fun stuff. And he looked, I remember him looking at me once when I was kind of trying to squeeze one of our children into clothes. And he goes, "You're doing that?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I didn't talk to you till you were 21." I didn't feel like I needed to react against my father because I adored my father. I could see that he offered a wonderful example of how to have a wonderful relationship with your children without doing any of the dirty work. But the world's changed. A man cannot not do the dirty work anymore.
So what is an ideal father today, a perfect father, and what would a more honest model of a perfect father be?
Well, I think that there's the question of what is a perfect father, and then there's the question of what's the perfect husband. I think that if you floated this subject at the dinner table in Berkeley, California, they would say the perfect husband and father is someone who's doing exactly half the parenting, half the dirty work.
Do you think that happens in most of those homes?
No, I don't. Not at all. People lie about it, and they're very uncomfortable about it. I mean, this is something that's very interesting to me, just the politics of parenting, that if you find yourself in a social situation with people who divide up the parenting duties radically differently, it invariably becomes at least a hidden source of friction. That people want to. There are no norms now, right? There are no standards. There's every version of dividing up the responsibilities under the sun out there in America, and that's in a lot of ways to the good. But the absence of standards creates anxiety. There's no question. Creates social anxiety. And people, when asked what they do, they give the answer that they think is the right answer for where they are. If you ask that question in Berkeley, the right answer is 50-50. If you ask that question in Memphis, Tennessee, what are you talking about? It just depends on where you are. I think that every couple comes to their own deal, and there are lots of good deals, and it just depends on lots of things.
My guest is Michael Lewis, whose latest book is a real departure from the bestsellers we have come to expect from him, Moneyball, The New Thing, Liar's Poker, The Blind Side. He is currently a contributing editor of Vanity Fair, columnist for Bloomberg News, and he served as an editor and columnist for the British weekly The Spectator, as a senior editor and foreign correspondent for The New Republic, and as a contributing writer to The New York Times Magazine and Slate. His latest book, Home Game, is published by Norton. No matter what you do, your kid's going to turn out to be who the kid is. And you tell a story of your daughter saying something to another kid that would have shocked me, and you can't say it on the air. How old?
So what are we going to do with
she?
She was three.
Were you surprised that she knew those words?
I was shocked. I was shocked. But the story is hearing the words in the context that she used them. She used them to frighten away a group of boys who were terrorizing her older sister. I was proud of her. I couldn't honestly say that I disapproved. And you say this book is a departure for me, but it's funny. It's not that much. Because the feeling that I had, what motivated me to write about this experience, is exactly what motivated me to write Liar's Poker. It was, I've landed in this situation. In that case, it was Wall Street, a high-paying Wall Street job that I was really not very well suited for, and it seemed like a senseless situation. And in order to make sense of it, I really had to sit and kind of noodle over it and write about it. And this was a similarly unsettling experience.
To some degree, it's the sort of thing that Buster Keaton made movies about, the normal guy who finds himself in an experience that is more overwhelming than he could ever have imagined.
And for which he's just totally unprepared.
Yeah. Well, you do also write about having a vasectomy, which your wife didn't want you to have.
No, she did want me to have. No, she did. This was the long list of things no one tells you about until you're in them it's incredible. I mean, when we had our third child, you would think we would know everything there was to know. We came home from the hospital, and 8 hours later, my wife has her fingernails in my arms in the middle of the night and saying, I feel like a character in a horror movie who's about to be the next victim. I'm that terrified. I can't not have you here. And it was this weird hormonal reaction called postpartum panic attack. And it went on for weeks. And it was absolutely bizarre. No one had mentioned it ever before. The vasectomy was a bit like this too. No one explains one what it's going to feel like when they do it. But the thing that was actually oddly unsettling was how you prove that it worked, and which you the doctor that I used had told me a couple of interesting things. He said, as I was laying on the table being operated on, I said, you know, this is so unpleasant. I said, and it's so the run up to it is so unnatural, to let someone carve on you down there kind of thing. That I said, have you ever had anybody, you come into the operating room and you found the table empty because they've just fled down the street? Because I had that impulse to just get up and run. And he said, it's funny you should ask. He said, well, that hasn't happened, but you know, about a third, or maybe it's more like a half, of the people who schedule the operation don't show. And then, this was even more amazing, and it's such a guy thing. They get the operation, which is horrible, and after they have the operation, they never show to verify whether it worked. And I have met several women who were impregnated this way by their husbands.
So you had dreams that you might very well wind up impregnating your wife despite the operation.
Yeah, well, it wasn't so much dreams, but I had people telling me that you better go because I didn't, and look what happened. We have these twins that we didn't expect. And it is a huge number of men don't get, and it is socially unbelievably awkward to walk into the room and talk to the lady behind the counter and discuss this thing about which, you know, how are we going to produce this sample kind of thing with eight women reading People magazine staring at you and talking about you behind your back.
Michael Lewis's latest book, Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood, is quite funny. Also, I think a lot of people will recognize themselves in it. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.